Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Today on the show, a story about how a federal subsidy could help wind energy surge forward in Wyoming if the state decides to welcome it.
We just need to kind of embrace it and not pose the wind development. Let it happen, right?
We'll also hear about an upcoming musical satire at UW that challenges the status quo of politics.
We make fun of everybody, and hopefully if you laugh enough, you can relax enough to have a conversation.
And University of Wyoming President Lori Nichols is looking forward to a number of initiatives, including entrepreneurship.
Would in fact start to introduce some businesses, industry services to the economy that we may not have right now in Wyoming.
It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Wyoming has the potential to be one of the country's top wind energy producers. Obviously, one benefit, it's really windy. But the state is lagging behind others in vying for these kinds of development projects. And a window may be closing to get in on the wind energy boom. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim has more.
In April of this year, the utility company Rocky Mountain Power, or RMP, announced a $3.5 billion investment in wind energy, spanning Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming. Their project will add new wind generation to the Western Electric Grid, upgrade turbine technology, and build a much-needed new transmission line, Gateway West, which can carry generated energy out of Wyoming. And there's a specific deadline for all that.
We need to have these projects in the ground and fully operational by the end of 2020 to qualify for the production tax credit. And so that is the driver of doing these projects now.
That's Rita Meyer, Vice President of RMP in Wyoming. She explains the production tax credit, or PTC, provides a couple cents for each kilowatt hour of wind energy produced. The benefit applies to any wind project built before the end of 2019, or in 2020 if some factors are met, in the last 10 years. Meyer says the PTC makes this project economically viable. And it's not just her company that's taking advantage.
I think we're seeing a real spurt now in activity because of the production tax credit and the idea that it will probably drop off after this final push.
This past quarter, there were almost 30,000 megawatts of wind capacity under construction or in development nationwide. The American Wind Energy Association says that's a record. Things may slow down if the GOP tax reform bill goes through as currently written. It slashes the wind power PTC. Still, the current credit is pushing a compressed timeline for wind projects. Jonathan Naughton is director of the Wind Energy Research Center, the University of Wyoming.
It's going to move development that would have occurred over, say, the next 10 years. It's going to kind of move a lot of that into the next 4 years.
So this window of time could set the stage for where wind energy is produced for years. Many states are positioning themselves to take the lead. Iowa and New Mexico, for example, have state tax breaks for wind energy produced. Texas even funded their own transmission line, ensuring wind developers could actually send their power somewhere. Naughton says Wyoming could be a contender.
And it's very possible because of the quality of the resource we have, the infrastructure that's going into place in terms of transmission. That would take us from being kind of a minor player, and that would vault us right into the top five.
But Wyoming is the only state in the country that taxes wind production, and there's talk about raising that tax.
That can make companies nervous. So we need to give some stability. We need to provide signs that Wyoming's really welcoming the development. We just need to kind of, you know, embrace it and not oppose the wind development. Let it happen, right?
We shouldn't be rushing into this.
That's Cale Case. He's a Wyoming state senator. Despite the state's wind potential, there are a lot of people here who don't want the state to jump headfirst into big wind investment.
Our wind resources are going to be here for a long time. We have to think about developing them carefully. And so I think it's a good time to take a deep breath.
Wyoming's economy depends on severance taxes from the state's extractive industries, coal, natural gas, oil. Why not wind?
I think we need to get a permanent, sustainable tax to compensate us for what's happening. This will allow us to do, you know, to have revenue for future generations of Wyoming folks to build schools, roads, and take care of the things we need to take care of.
And Wyoming's wind potential is just that, potential. Other states with less wind are becoming increasingly viable places to set up turbines. Currently, Wyoming is ranked 15th in installed wind capacity. far behind states like Texas and Iowa. Paul Martin is the president of Intermountain Wind, based out of Denver. He says the state of Wyoming has to do more if it wants to rise in the ranks. Specifically, he says it should find ways to increase transmission capacity, so there's actually a way to send the power somewhere.
The state could definitely be a leader in the wind industry if it encouraged the industry and invested in transmission to allow for the industry to continue.
Wind proponents point to the industry as a way to bring more jobs and revenue to Wyoming. That's appealing for a state increasingly looking to diversify its economy away from a fossil fuel dependence. But a wholesale shift in favor of wind is not likely to come quickly enough to take advantage of the current window of opportunity. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Late last week, President Trump told Utah lawmakers that the Bears Ears National Monument, designated in the waning days of the Obama administration, would be downsized. That message is in line with recommendations from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Like Trump, Zinke favors boosting production of oil and gas reserves on federal lands to create jobs and enhance the nation's energy security. It's another pro-industry headline for a secretary touting himself not only as an avid outdoorsman, but a follower of the conservation ideals of the 26th President of the United States, Theodore Roosevelt. Inside Energy's Dan Boyce looks at how their philosophies stack up.
Pretty much any chance he gets, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke brings up his idol.
And up front, I'm a Teddy Roosevelt guy.
Teddy Roosevelt had the courage 100 years ago. The reorganization is going to be bold and look at just as Teddy Roosevelt did.
And if the manager of most of our federal lands is going to take after anybody, it's hard to find a more appropriate muse.
Roosevelt is generally regarded as the father of the modern conservation movement.
This is Whit Fosberg. He's president and CEO of the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership.
When he was president, he set aside somewhere around 230 million acres of public lands for the future of people forever.
That's larger than the states of Texas and Wyoming combined. It includes 150 national forests, 5 national parks, 51 wildlife refuges, 4 national game preserves, and 18 national monuments. Zinke often pays his respects to that legacy while still pushing the pro-industry line of the Trump administration. Here he is earlier this year at an event called Unleashing American Energy.
Our public lands are unique on this globe. We want to make sure we protect them, cultivate them, but you can use them wisely.
Reporter Michael Doyle covers the interior for E&E News in Washington, D.C. He says that's all part of Zinke's agenda.
Very explicitly part of his agenda to open up the public lands to greater use under the theory that they belong to the public for multiple use.
This is an ideological struggle over public lands that goes back at least to Roosevelt. The country's different land designations, whether national park or wilderness area or whatever, all have different rules. Let's call it a conservation spectrum. On one end, you have multiple use lands, like national forests, that allow timber harvests or energy development, with the understanding those lands will eventually be left in good condition. On the other end of the spectrum would be lands managed for preservation, like national parks, the goal being to keep those places as close to their natural state as possible. Roosevelt believed in that entire spectrum and designated lands accordingly. And in that way, reporter Michael Doyle says Zinke does take after Roosevelt.
Secretary Zinke, he has complicated, nuanced views, even if at the same time, industry is probably going to win more battles in his department than it loses.
Zinke's department recently unveiled a controversial plan to double some entrance fees to help shore up a major budget shortfall for the national parks. Also, he's been jetting around the country visiting parks to increase their exposure. Still, perhaps the most criticized move of the new secretary's tenure has been his recommendations to shrink the size of at least 4 national monuments. If the recent news on Bears Ears is any indication, their recommendations the president intends to follow. The law creating national monuments was signed by none other than Teddy Roosevelt. Here's the Sierra Club's Dan Ritzman.
It's terribly ironic that we have somebody who likes to call up the name and compare himself to Teddy Roosevelt, but the major thing that he has done in his 9 months as Secretary of the Interior is try to undo this act that was signed by Roosevelt and to strip protections away from places that were protected using this act.
Zinke argues the original law says monuments should set aside the smallest amount of land possible to protect sites of national interest. He says the monuments he recommends shrinking do not follow the spirit of that law. However, in his recommendations to President Trump, Zinke also suggests establishing 3 new national monuments. The White House says the president will travel to Utah to make a formal announcement in December. For Inside Energy, I'm Dan Boyce.
When we come back, Wyoming lawmakers are pleased with the Trump administration's approach to rolling back EPA regulations like Waters of the U.S. It's also time to get your health insurance, and if you live in Wyoming, you might get a pleasant surprise. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The EPA's announcement that it's rolling back an Obama-era rule to expand regulations on the nation's waters and streams is being cheered by Wyoming lawmakers, who are now offering input on how to rewrite it. But correspondent Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that Democrats say it's a part of a disturbing trend at the EPA.
Farmers and ranchers across Wyoming were up in arms over the regulation, commonly referred to as the Waters of the U.S. rule. It would have expanded the scope of what the EPA and other federal agencies regulate, which had many fearing the government would be monitoring dry stream beds and puddles. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso is praising the move to undo it.
You know, in the past, the federal government has tried to take over all the water, and I think we do a great job in Wyoming in protecting our waters, protecting our environment, and doing it in a way that shows proper respect for the environment as well as allows for the multiple use of the land. That's the history of Wyoming. We want clean air, we want clean water, we want clean land, and we do it very well.
But now the agency has to come up with a new rule to replace the Obama-era one. As Barrasso hopped on the trains underneath the Capitol, he explained he wants to make sure the rule remains laser-focused.
There is a federal role, and it has to do with truly navigable waters. And people in Wyoming know what we mean when we talk about navigable waters. But this effort previously by the Obama administration to take control over all waters was really harmful to Wyoming, to agriculture, but also to other folks who use the land.
But now we're all in a waiting period to see what the EPA will offer as a replacement rule. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says that should be easy.
Well, I'd like to see him, you know, at a minimum, go back to the notion of navigable waterways and not have the kind of expansive definition that we saw in the last administration.
But Democrats say the EPA and many in the public are overreacting. Arizona's Raul Grijalva is the top Democrat on the Natural Resources Committee.
They're making, making it a conspiracy, which it isn't. Unwinding it also, you know, affects management, protective issues that are involved.
Democrats say unwinding the water rule is a part of a dangerous trend during the Trump era. After already pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, the administration also announced this week it's barring some scientists from serving the EPA in an advisory capacity if they received EPA funding grants during their careers. Grijalva says it's a dangerous trend.
It goes against science. It continues that campaign to effectively limit and marginalize science and fact in a department that relies on science and fact to protect the American public and their public health. It is an industry giveaway, and the people that are replacing them are all coming from industry.
While EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt enacted these new rules for scientists, no such prohibition came on people involved in energy or other industries who he wants to put on the advisory panel. Cheney lauds the move by Pruitt.
I think now we've got a huge amount of redundant regulation that's unnecessary. So I'm very optimistic and heartened by the kinds of steps we've seen Pruitt begin to take across the board.
Cheney goes farther than Pruitt and sides with about 7 House Republicans who want to completely disband the EPA.
I don't think, frankly, that you need an EPA, period. I think that when you've got the states themselves and 98% of the environmental regulation being done effectively at a state level, that's where it ought to be.
Rank-and-file Republicans know their party leaders would never bring a bill to the floor to disband the EPA. But Democrats say they've been concerned with Pruitt because the former Oklahoma Attorney General was known for suing the agency he now runs. Virginia Democrat Don Beyer says Pruitt seems to be dismantling the agency from within.
Well, I think it was just the worst case of putting the fox in charge of the in-house. So it's very much in his economic interest, the economic interest of the state that he's represented to try to kill anything related to climate change and just in general to deregulate our protection of the environment. And he's in the strongest position to do it, unfortunately.
But Cheney and other Republicans brush aside the criticisms from the minority party on everything from the Waters of the U.S. rule to pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement.
I'm sure the Democrats don't like what's happening, but the Democrats lost the election for a reason. And they lost the election because people in states like Wyoming are absolutely fed up with an EPA that was not regulating the environment, not doing things to improve the environment, but was targeted on killing key industries like the fossil fuel industry and the coal industry. And so I feel really good about the fact that we've taken important steps moving away from that.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
It's open enrollment time for health insurance, and for those choosing their insurance on the federal marketplace, there is interesting news for Wyoming residents. Subsidy payments for those on the marketplace have increased, and so in many cases, people can get more affordable and possibly better coverage. Monica Jennings is an Enroll Wyoming navigator, and I asked her if people should reconsider their health care coverage and possibly find a new plan.
Yes, yes, and yes. They need to revisit their plans because the plans and prices have changed. Some folks, work with people that were on a silver plan last year. They are looking at maybe going to a gold plan just because the premium and the deductible is working out for them better this year. So we recommend if they don't come directly to us, then they at least go onto healthcare.gov and visit the preview plans and prices to see what's available to them.
I'm sure you've met with people over the last few years that have done it on their own and have gone to a navigator. Is it better to go to a navigator, do you think?
Here's what I can tell you. I work with a woman who for 2 years in a row did it independently, and she had a lot of problems, and she was the only one fighting those battles. And yesterday she did come and visit with the navigator. We got her set up. I answered questions for her, and she said, man, doing this with you is so easy because at least you'll work with me on it and I don't feel so alone in this process.
And it probably goes a little quicker, I would think, since you know the process.
Yeah. We've seen a lot of things happen over the years of doing this, so we are able to provide that insight for folks.
Okay, so we have all reported that prices are going to go up, probably policies are going to explode and get out of sight, that kind of thing. So my question to you is that what you're seeing? Are all the policies in the state of Wyoming going up?
So what I have experienced for those folks who are actually on the exchange, on Marketplace and got a plan through healthcare.gov, they are getting significant cost assistance this year. And so we are encouraging people, like I worked with folks yesterday who got a gold level plan for $0. They had a deductible of $750. That is unheard of typically, right? I work with another woman. She paid $65 for her silver level plan, but her deductible was only $50. So this is the year for Wyoming. Because of the changes with the cost sharing reduction, it's still a part of the law to offer that. So instead of the federal government paying for that, Blue Cross Blue Shield is, you know, had to do some adjustments in their rates, and is actually faring better for Wyoming residents this year.
That's interesting, because normally our prices are quite a bit higher than everybody else.
Yeah, normally they are, but they still have to use the calculations and offer the extra help for folks. So
would you anticipate then there's some people that might be able to improve their insurance situation? So, you know, maybe you can go up to that gold plan.
A lot of people are in that boat. We are encouraging people, it's not okay to just let your plan roll over this year. This is the year to actually actively either visit with the navigator. You can do that by dialing 211 anywhere in the state of Wyoming. We have a calendar that's on the Wyoming 211's website, and that tells you exactly where we will be. The letter that you should have received from Blue Cross Blue Shield, that's going to be printed on a blue form. That also says in the letter to dial 211 to link up with us, and we will sit down and go over it with you. If you can't make it to the events, we're actually doing some telehealth. So people can call in, and then I can share my computer screen with folks. We have different locations, including Laramie Reproductive Health, where we are today, and they will allow you to come in and use their computer so that I can meet with folks via telehealth if they are not able to make the events when they're scheduled.
Any other surprises you're seeing with the insurance this year that maybe people wouldn't expect?
Here's what is still in place and what people need to know. Number one, it is still the law. So they need to know that if they do not have coverage for 2018, they are still subject to the tax penalty. And so people think that that's going away. Well, it is still $695 per uninsured adult, or 2.5% of the household income, whichever is greater. And if the kids are in the home that don't have coverage, then it's half that for the child. So that's one thing people need to know. The other thing is that all of the essential health benefits that were a part of the plan from the beginning are still a part of the plan. So it's a comprehensive plan that will be that folks can get coverage with. Mm-hmm. So those things, I guess, in terms of surprises, the surprise is we're still here. And the law is still in place. And, you know, for nothing more than just taking care of yourself, get covered.
The deadline is when again?
December 15th. So we started November 1st. The deadline is December 15th. That is kind of a surprise, I guess, now that to Wyoming residents, because typically the open enrollment period has been longer, much longer. And when folks heard that December 15th deadline, then they thought, oh, well, that's just if I want coverage starting January, but I'm okay. That's not the case. December 15th is it. You got to get in or you're going to miss it.
Okay. And so again, if folks want to get signed up, what do they need to do?
Folks need to get signed up. Number one, they need to dial 211, and then 211 will let them know where we're located. They can also visit healthcare.gov. If they're going to do that on their own and preview plans and prices, I've been telling everyone the price that comes up when you see it might say $1,018, that is how much help you're getting. That is your discount. That's not the cost of your plan. Keep clicking continue. That's the biggest thing. And we're more than happy to walk through folks with that over the phone. If they prefer to do it by themselves, we'll still assist them over the phone.
Okay, Monica Jennings, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, the University of Wyoming's Department of Theater and Dance may raise some eyebrows with a new performance. And we'll visit an art show involving Native American comic books. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Both private and public institutions are bound by federal law to respond to reports of sexual harassment and abuse. In the workplace, it's Title VII. In educational settings, it's Title IX. But this fall, the U.S. Department of Education announced its plans to overhaul the guideline. In response, UW law students organized a panel of university administrators to address potential changes. A Laramie attorney, who has represented a student facing sexual misconduct violations, spoke out at the event. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson followed up with Linda Devine to get her take.
What called you to go and be a part of that event?
The main reason I went was to hear the university's perspective on the changes being proposed from the Department of Education, the new secretary. And I was a little disappointed when I got there to find that I didn't see anyone on the panel representing individuals that are accused of any type of sexual assault on campus. And so that gave me some concern. And keep in mind, nobody wants sexual assault to happen on campus. I don't. But I just am really concerned with the way that the process goes.
And what is your experience with the process?
So I can speak in general terms because I don't want to violate any confidentiality. My experience with the process is quite frustrating.
Can you say how many cases you've worked on involving students and sexual misconduct at the university?
With the sexual misconduct, probably only two cases. I've only had one that I've gone through a full-blown out hearing on. I can't get into the specifics of that, but primarily, I don't believe there is enough due process for the individual that's accused. And let me give you an example of just process-wise. Under the Code of Student Conduct, the Dean of Students can initiate a temporary suspension for 45 days. The student has the right to appeal that, but it's the Vice President of Student Affairs that appeals it. There's inherently a conflict of interest because the individual that imposes the temporary suspension is usually within the same department as the individual handling the appeal. So that's really concerning. But the other thing on that, too, is so there's the initial temporary suspension that can last 45 days. Then the dean on his own can extend that for another 45 days, still without any kind of a hearing. What happens is students will end up withdrawing because now we're talking 3 months into the semester and there's no way you're going to be able to catch up with your classes. You don't have access to anything on the school. You can't even do anything online. You know, you're off campus. And so students risk, one, failing classes, or two, if they don't withdraw, they can lose their tuition that they've already paid for.
And on the flip side, I've also talked to survivors who feel like when the cases aren't handled efficiently or they don't feel adequately supported, their inclination was also to leave school.
Keep in mind, when I say these things about the due process, I think the way that the university handles these cases isn't really that fair to the alleged victim either, because, in my opinion, it seems arbitrary, because some cases of sexual misconduct, they automatically will suspend someone. But then there are other cases of sexual misconduct where they've allowed the individual, whether it's a professor or a student, remain on campus. And then you have the alleged victim there, still trying to go to school, and the alleged perpetrator is still there. So it just seems like there's not any rhyme or reason on how they decide.
Do you have a sense of where that lies? Is that about the university's interpretation of the guidelines, or is it a problem with the guidelines themselves? You know, where do we need to shine the spotlight to figure out how to fix this problem?
You know, I think perhaps in some ways our state legislators could decide whether or not hearings through the University of Wyoming should follow like the rules of the Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act. I think that would be certainly an option. You could always have an attorney that pushed a button long enough to get it to the Supreme Court. That takes time. One would hope that perhaps you could get folks at the university and perhaps attorneys to come together and develop some type of procedure where the accused due process rights are being upheld at the same time the victim's rights are also being upheld. Someone needs to start coming together and talking about it, because if we don't, you're going to have these things continue. And it's not just this university. I think universities all over the country struggle with this. You know, I'm a University of Wyoming fan. I graduated here. You know, my intent isn't to disparage the university at all. I appreciate the work that they do in the community. But I just think that there's just a lot of ambiguity, I suppose you could say, with the way that the whole process goes.
I've been speaking with attorney Linda Devine. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Last February, UW President Nichols charged Associate Vice President Sean Blackburn and interim Title IX Coordinator Jim Osborne with forming a task force to expand sexual assault prevention and response efforts.
Ever since the 2016 presidential election, some have seen American politics as extremely partisan and polarized. People are finding it difficult to find common ground on serious issues. So, the University of Wyoming Department of Theater and Dance is trying something unique, singing about it. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard reports.
It's a nighttime rehearsal at UW's Buchanan Center for the Performing Arts, and the cast of Fascism the Musical breaks into some standard warm-ups.
Grab a big breath.
Ah.
But once they get into the meat of the show, the songs aren't so standard.
Feel that warm tingling come trickling down, that good, great, godly gift from on high. The cup that...
I guess one of its next-door neighbors would be South Park. It definitely lives in that zip code.
That's Sean Stone, Fascism the Musical's composer and musical director. The show leans left politically and is pretty raunchy and irreverent.
But, you know, the things we're talking about is the destruction of American ideology, and you can't give that too much reverence. You can't give that too much solemnity. Because, God, who'd want to watch that?
The comedy revolves around a fictional 24-hour news channel, Wolf News Network. The protagonist, a journalist named Lizzie, organizes a strike to protest the fact that corporate interests and advertisers dictate what they report.
Sisters, did you ever think that we are the problem? We smile at the cameras and read off of the cue cards. It's time to end the corporate stranglehold on the media. Time to stop broadcasting sound bites and going only for ratings.
In the first act, the head of Wolf News tries to prove why capitalism works. In the second act, Lizzie flips the script to show the pitfalls of capitalism. Fascism's playwright and director, William Missouri Downs, says freedom of speech and freedom of the press are both questioned.
So we have songs that make fun of trickle-down economics. We have songs that make fun of socialism. We have songs that make fun of guns on campus, the student loan debt crisis.
In other words, nothing is off limits.
It's very satirical. We make fun of everybody. And hopefully, if you laugh enough, you can relax enough to have a conversation.
Crazy pants Americans of such a way of living.
So many things you pay for to us are simply given.
If you want to make an omelet, you have to break some yokas. Boost your own economy with a socialism polka.
The show may make fun of everyone, but it does portray a particular point of view, that economic fascism exists in the United States.
And certainly what's happening in this country now is that we're a fascist state. Now, we're not a dictatorship, the other meaning of the word. And we try to bring that out and let people know that private entities, individuals, and corporations have more power and more say in your life than the government does.
But this is Wyoming, and there are students in the program that are not on board with the show's message. Some, in fact, were hesitant to audition, including Jordan Clark. She describes herself as politically conservative.
I mean, I just have a different set of political values that contradict with what the show's trying to say.
But she says she's a musical theater major and felt obligated to at least audition. But as opening night approaches, she isn't as worried.
I'm feeling a lot better than I did, you know, because we're starting to get more solid. I told my parents not to come, so they are not coming. But that's okay. I have my best friends here who will be coming to the show, and I've been telling them what's going on, so they know what to expect.
UW assistant professor Kevin Inoue is co-directing the show along with Downs. He says with its potentially controversial material, a protest piece like Fascism the Musical will test many different boundaries at the university. And for that reason, they've kept campus administration in the loop about the content of the show.
We don't want to take anybody by surprise. We don't want them hearing from somebody else out of the blue that we're doing material that is going to get a bunch of people up in arms, which, you know, again, I don't think it will. But so we have tried to keep those lines of communication open.
Fascism the Musical opens November 14th. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caroline Ballard.
The world is changed.
Comic books get kids thinking about complex issues. That's definitely the case for an art show now up at the Cheyenne Frontier Days Old West Museum. All the comic book art in this show is by Native American artists. The museum's marketing director, Morgan Marks, gave Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards a tour that starts with the illustrated robe of the great Eastern Shoshone chief Washakie. Mark says it shows how deeply ingrained picture storytelling is in Native American cultures.
It looks like there's a lot of buffalo here. It looks like a buffalo hunt may be happening.
So it's like his own storytelling piece here. And I think this is such an incredible entrance into the exhibit because this is really cool.
Yeah, what a unique piece.
The Old West Museum, our mission is to cultivate and preserve the Western legacy of Cheyenne Frontier Days, and Native Americans have been part of that story since the very second Frontier Day. Some members from our staff were able to go to the first Indigenous Comic-Con in Albuquerque last November, and we collected a lot of artifacts from there, meeting Indigenous creators from all over the country and up into Canada. And we have comic books, posters. This Never Alone is a game, like a computer game, that is an award-winning computer game.
My kids have played that. It's amazing.
I really want to play that. I know our exhibit's curators' kids love it. It just seems so sweet.
Yes, yeah.
And then this is a Wyoming artist, Robert Martinez. He also had a show at the Wyoming State Museum in Cheyenne. He makes sure to use really beautiful, vibrant colors. And so we
almost
have...
almost neon, like
yes.
This one over here where... The skin,
Kiss.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kiss. Like the band Kiss, and then but it's bright yellow, neon like skin tones, but with pink.
But these are what you'd kind of think of as traditional sitting poses with like really pop culture icons on top of them, which fits what we're hoping to do perfectly, which is allow people to reclaim their own identity rather than have it forced upon them. This artist, Z.M. Thomas, his Sioux Falls is a very steampunk.
Sioux Falls is the name of the comic book.
Yes, this mm-hmm. is the name of the comic book. And if you look over here, we were able to blow this one up, all like robot horses. And this one talks about one of the largest mass hangings in the United States, and one of his ancestors was hung at this. And so it's very historically relevant because it's something that is not discussed nearly enough. And you wouldn't expect steampunk and mass hangings from the mid-1800s together. And then in this section, we have two different artists, Sean Bayale and Dale Ray DeForest. And they both talk about Hero Twins, the Navajo origin story. So Dale Ray DeForest does a more traditional telling of this, a very macho comic book style, two male twins. And the city wall has all the neon colors. Again, neon oranges and yellows and blues. And then Sean Bayale decided to change that story a little bit. So rather than two male twins, he has a male and a female twin. And we have here, it's pen and pencil drawing of one of the twins. And he wanted to really honor the women of his heritage and let them have a voice in the origin story here.
Yeah.
And this is one that I was telling you that doesn't actually have any dialogue. And this artist, Jonathan Nelson, he uses this sheep character, Jonesy, and you follow Jonesy's struggles. So it starts off with Jonesy is just graduated from high school. He's really hot. He's uncomfortable. And so he shears himself and he tries to sell his wool, but because he doesn't have pure white wool, they won't take it.
So this is clearly a commentary on race.
Yes. And sheep are a very important part of Jonathan's heritage. And so sheep is a very logical person for him to pick.
Yeah.
And then behind here, we do have a viewer discretion warning here, because this is for Dear Woman. This artist, Elizabeth LaPense, got permission from her tribe elder to depict Dear Woman. And it's a very sad but powerful and kind of violent story about a woman who was assaulted, and then she becomes Dear Woman to keep herself from ever getting assaulted again and to prevent others from being assaulted. And
that is a very important issue for a lot of tribes, that their sexual assault in mm-hmm. on reservations is really high, so I can see that would be a very important issue to depict. And so this is sort of a superhero fighting off a very relevant social issue. Yeah.
And as you can see in these panels, in one of these, she was being attacked by a police officer, and the police officer does die in them. There's other panels where she starts to transform, where she's the woman, but you have a deer as a shadow. This one just gives me goosebumps. It's a comic book vignette, and so it's not very long, and in reading it, it's incredibly powerful. This is also very muted. It's all black and white.
How long is the show itself going to be?
The show will be up through mid-February, February 17. And we are doing table gaming nights and book club nights on alternate months, second Wednesday at 5:30. And so if either of those are things that are interesting, they're free. With the book clubs, we are requesting help buying your book. But
other than that,
you can come and enjoy and talk and be in this really vibrant exhibit.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards at the Cheyenne Frontier Days Old West Museum, talking with Marketing Director Morgan Marks.
When we come back, an interview with University of Wyoming President Lori Nichols. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's been a rough couple of years for the University of Wyoming. We're budget cutting. Layoffs and reorganization have been themes. Lately, the focus has been on less stressful ventures, like enhancing STEM teaching, diversity, and a variety of initiatives. One issue for University of Wyoming President Lori Nichols is to try to address the lack of faculty and staff pay raises. She begins our conversation by saying that those raises should be here in July.
When we went through the budget reduction last year, I tried to be very transparent and open about this, that as we took that cut, we went a little deeper than we needed to just to meet the minimum state block grant reduction. And part of the reason we did that was I was trying very hard to build in a salary increase, which we need to fund ourselves. So this is an internally funded salary increase that we worked to build in as we went. And you know, knock on wood, we were successful in getting enough funds built into that we can roll a salary increase if the board would approve it this year.
Okay, and so that would be sometime in July?
Actually, we'll probably ask the board to approve that in March, and then the salary increase would go into effect July 1.
A couple of things I want to ask you about. One is maybe update some of the listeners on the science initiative. I know that's a big thing, and we're starting to see some headway there. Could you tell us what's going on there and maybe just refresh folks' memory about what this is?
So the building is kind of the third building, if you will, on Lewis Street that builds out our STEM corridor. The first, of course, was the NC STEM building, and then that was followed by what's being built right now, the engineering building, and the third will be the Science Initiative building. And that really will complete the strong focus and what I'd call really enhancement around STEM education at the University of Wyoming. The building is a $100 million building, very state-of-the-art. It has a beautiful active learning classroom in it for up to 200 students. So this would be a great enhancement in terms of our classrooms. But in addition to that, it's a great amount of it is research. It's a big research facility that will enhance our interdisciplinary cutting-edge research around the life sciences.
Visiting with the University of Wyoming President Lori Nichols, you recently hired someone to look after a new diversity initiative that you've got here on campus. What are you after in that? What's the end goal here?
The end goal is to make sure that we have a campus and a university that is diverse, that is open and inclusive, where students from all backgrounds are welcome and in fact feel welcomed on our campus. So that's really the end goal. What our chief diversity officer is working on right now, well, she's working on a plan, a 5-year plan for us to really build diversity on this campus. But she's also looking at our policies, our processes, our programming, and making sure that wherever we may have voids, that we're really filling those in now so that we have a very, very complete diversity program for this university.
Is it more about addressing students' needs, or is it also making sure that we have people of color and that kind of thing teaching here?
It's both. We want to make sure that we're recruiting students that come from diverse backgrounds, including students of color, but also even more diverse than that. It considers age, religion, political perspective, the whole thing. So we really want to make sure we have students that are diverse and that we're supporting all students on this campus. But we also want to make sure we're recruiting faculty and staff that come from diverse backgrounds as well. And when I'm out in Wyoming, I say this, is that this is as important for Wyoming students as it is for anyone else, because our students will go out and they will live and work in a very diverse global world. And we have to make sure we're preparing them well.
I want to ask you about a topic that's been in the news. It's certainly on my mind because it was a problem at NPR here recently, and certainly we've been hearing a lot more about it, but sexual harassment issues. And how prepared are we to deal with some of these things? Or it's certainly popping up more and more, unfortunately.
It certainly is. I think we're quite prepared to deal with it, but we can always be better. So I know when I came in, I pulled together a group and I just said, regardless of where you think we're at as a campus, I would like to do more. I think that we need to continually work on education, on prevention, on intervention, making sure that we're doing absolutely everything we can and should be doing as a campus. And so we have a No More campaign going. We're in fact just working right now on rolling out a new initiative on that in the next few weeks around the last football game. So we're constantly working on trying to make sure we keep it kind of in the public, and we're talking about it, and we're educating students and faculty and staff on it as we go.
Let's shift our attention a little bit to the economy and economic development. And one of the things that I know the governor mentioned when he spoke with you a year ago last summer is, having you involved in his Endow program, looking at diversifying our economy. Where are we with that? Have we set something up to get this rolling, or did we tell him to go to hell, or I don't know what we said?
No, we're working on it. We do see ourselves as being part of the Endow initiative. Obviously not the whole thing by any stretch, but a piece of it. And so as we've had conversations with the people who are leading the Endow initiative, including the governor, part of what we have talked about, well, there's kind of three things I can touch on. One is that as a state, we need an educational attainment goal. That is, we need to raise the educational profile in the state and make sure that we have even more educated individuals that would be prepared for the workplace that we envision for the future. So that's one. A second one, of course, is making sure that we're producing the right kinds of graduates out of this university, and quite honestly, the community colleges are having similar conversation, so that we're producing students who are ready to go to work in Wyoming and be prepared to take jobs in Wyoming, and some of these will be newly created jobs as we go. And then the third piece we're working on right now is really infusing a very strong culture of entrepreneurship and innovation on our campus. And so we're working on a plan right now that will roll out a university-wide concept for how we can really create a stronger ecosystem of innovation and entrepreneurship, including working with our faculty so that as they do their research in the labs or out in the field, and as they have innovations, research that can turn into more commercial products, we are ready to work with them. And so we need to up our game in that regard a bit too, and we're working on that.
We certainly have had some success stories coming out of this university, but is this an effort where you're hoping to increase that by a couple fold?
Yes, that's the idea, is to build on successes, and you're absolutely right. We've had some real success stories out of the university that have commercialized and done well, but wherever we're at, we need to think about doubling that. So, and it's going to take real effort to get there, so we know that we've got to really up our game in terms of the kinds of education and support and even policies, quite honestly, that we have at this campus that really help our faculty when they have a discovery of some kind in the lab, that they have a very a smooth process by which they can access so that it can move more smoothly out into commercialization. Right now, it's still a little bumpy, if you will, just because we don't necessarily have the infrastructure we need to help faculty.
Do you see this as a situation where the entrepreneurship ties in really neatly with diversifying the economy effort? Because, as you said, you're trying to get students to maybe stay here in the state, but if there's no jobs for them.
Right, yes, and that's exactly right. We really see this effort as a way to diversify the economy in that these smaller startup companies that we would envision coming out of this more entrepreneurial university would, in fact, start to introduce some businesses, industry services to the economy that we may not have right now in Wyoming.
University of Wyoming President Lori Nichols, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear an individual segment, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We are always looking for interesting ideas for stories and interviews. You can send them to us through that website. We'll be taking next week off, but we will be back with a brand new show on November 17th. I'd like to mention that we'll also soon have a full-time Northwest Wyoming correspondent who will help enhance our coverage. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.